speak to us. And I ask you, Father, for your help now. And thank you for it in Yeshua's name. Imru. So, did you know nothing is impossible with God? Did you know that? How long is God's arm? I just want to explain something to you before I go on. I'm trying to learn to move my mouth more when I talk. What? You know, slapping someone isn't always wrong. I am working on that. I'll ask you to pray for me. I hope the time will come and there's only one reason that somebody cannot hear me, and that's because they're deaf. So, along with that, let's see. Okay, so I gave an exhortation for people to go with the promptings of the Spirit before the meeting, and I mentioned that it's my desire to see a fully functioning body. That requires room for the parts of the body to function. And I just want to thank all of you who read the scripture, said the words that you said, for following that prompting, because what's happened here today is much fuller and much better because you did that. And it should be, this place and everything we do here should be about the God who promised Abraham blessing for all the families of the earth through his line, Isaac, Jacob, and onward, King David, Yeshua. And and what that's about is, I'm having one of those I lost my train of thought things. What that's about is that because of Yeshua, because of what God has promised to bring to the earth through the people of Israel, anyone from any family anywhere on the earth can become part of the thing that God began to cultivate. And everyone matters and everyone has a part to play. So what it should be about as we glorify the Lord is playing our part, and there being room to play our part, and then appreciating that and what God's doing in us, and appreciating others and what God's doing in them, and making room for the part that they play, and coming to the point where we actually want every gift and function to be performed, even though some of those functions some of the time don't feel great. But they lead to one of my favorite lines in the scripture talks about the peaceful fruit of righteousness. And that is the result of going through a bunch of things, some of which we would say, well, I'll take it on this kind of a bun. You don't want that part. Patience. I'd like others to be patient with me. I don't want to suffer. I don't want this condiment and that one, but I like peace. I'll take that. I like redemption. I'll take that. I'd love to have a new life, but can I have it without the? Can I have it my way? And the good news about that is you can have it your way, because eventually you'll agree with God, and the way He wants it will be your way, and then it does actually become easier. And some things that weren't fun before, sometimes those things can even be kind of almost fun, maybe even fun. So anyway, I appreciate you all. You all matter. I thank you for sharing the things you shared. And, you know, sometimes a simple truth is a really big deal. I am his work in progress. I hope every one of us can say that and believe it about ourselves and accept it about others, that yes, it's God's work. He began it. It is in progress. It's not in progress. And so that is a very positive statement, even if it means there's still something left to be done. It's still resoundingly positive, and that's how it should sound. So I appreciate that. And let's see. You know, I love the passage from Titus that Bill read. And and then Jacob got up and made a declaration. I think the one thing he said was, I have victory because of Mashiach Yeshua. I like that word, Mashiach. Where'd you get that? death, which wanted to swallow us up, which the enemy of our souls wishes to engulf us with, is swallowed up in victory. That'd probably be good to repeat to ourselves several times every day. And then I actually can't exactly remember. I was trying to take notes, but sometimes if I don't do it quick enough, it's gone. But I remember, and my heart leaps for joy from what Miriam shared. And I can't. Anyway, I just want to say, I appreciate that anybody that will overcome inertia and just go with what they're prompted to do. And, you know, it doesn't always even have to seem like it makes sense, although I think all of this today obviously made sense. Sometimes things, you know, we almost feel like they don't make sense, but sometimes someplace it made a whole lot of sense and made a difference, even though we might have judged it as, oh, I don't want to do that. So I just want to encourage everyone to walk in the freedom that's been given to us in seeking to use the gifts you have and just promptings. They don't even have to be a gift per se. The Lord may have something he just wants us to do, and he lets us know in some fashion. May happen in different ways with each of us, but I want to encourage that. So moving on from there, let's see here. I was thinking that I might introduce a new thing. And so I will this time, and then I hope to continue it. It's called the Messianic Moment, the Messianic Moment for the week. I will roughly try to keep it to the word that sort of frames it, moment. So I was reading in Luke. By the way, I'd encourage you all to read through the Gospels. If you go a while without reading through the Gospels, sometimes you read them and you go, man, I don't even remember that. Which probably we should, I would hope I would never experience that, although sometimes with a different translation, something jogs in a different way. But whether you've read them once, whether you've not read them all, whether you've only read two of them, whether you've read them many times, I really don't care. The gospel is the power of God unto salvation, and it's in the Gospels. So it can only be good if you read it. If you haven't, read it much, that just means that you have a whole bunch of great stuff that you can benefit from by reading it now. It's all wonderful. So, in the seventh chapter of Luke, it says, after he had finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. Now a centurion had a servant who was sick at the point of death, who was highly valued by him. When the centurion heard about Yeshua, he sent to him elders of the Jews. Now, who was this centurion? A Roman officer. You suppose he was circumcised? Huh. Okay, I just wanted to place him. What?
It happened in a battle.
How does that happen?
What? I think I got it. It's the kind of thing I'm always tempted to expound on. I said tempted, you know. We're supposed to resist temptation. Okay, so this centurion heard about Yeshua, and he sent to him elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his servant. Now, if he sent elders of the Jews to Yeshua, that almost implies that he had a relationship of some sort with them. No?
Yeah, I mean, he could have been someone with power to tell them what to do.
Well, you know, it could have been, and he probably had that power. But let's keep reading. And when they came to Yeshua, they pleaded with him earnestly, saying, wow, they pleaded with him. This almost sounds like they have an interest in what's of importance to the centurion. He is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation. And he is the one who built our synagogue. So this uncircumcised Roman centurion who could tell them what to do and could abuse them and probably get by with it, has a relationship with them. These elders from the Jews actually go and plead with Yeshua to do what this man wants, and says he's worthy to have you do this for him. Now, I gotta say that what that sounds like to me is Jews acting the way Jews always meant them to in the world. That God? Did I say God? What? It sounded funny, so that's why I asked. My ear picked it up, and my mouth missed it. So, these were Jewish people acting in a way that corresponds to what God chose Israel for, which is to be a blessing to all the families of the earth, a light to the nations, a beacon of love, and for them to actually express it so that the world would come to know the God of Israel, not just Israel knowing the God of Israel. So they pleaded with him. Now, he had shown his love for Israel. He even built their synagogue for them. I imagine if he built it, that probably also means he invested in it. I don't know the exact nature of the whole thing, but if he built it, it sounds like it got built for them by people that weren't them because of this centurion who was definitely not one of them. So, Yeshua went with them. When he was not far from the house, by the way, did this centurion ever actually talk to Yeshua? What?
Not at this point.
He had power, and he was a citizen, I would assume. A citizen of the nation that had power over Israel, which gave him more rights than other people. And Yeshua went with them. When he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. So they tell Yeshua he's worthy. He sends more people out to say, I'm not worthy. He sounds humble. But yet, he is asking because he sent people to ask. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you. Therefore, I didn't think, hey, I'm hot enough stuff to actually come and speak with you personally. But say the word, and let my servant be healed. That's just huge. For I too am a man set under authority with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes. And to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it. He understands authority. He understands his own authority in a way that corresponds to a much, much greater and larger authority, which is God. And he has understood something about Yeshua. And he knows what he can do, and he knows he can do it, and he doesn't doubt it. And so he must see God's love being expressed, even though he still doesn't think of himself as worthy to actually come and speak to Yeshua personally. So he declares his faith by the way he describes the working of authority and the authority that he knows that Yeshua has. And so it says, when Yeshua heard these things, he marveled at him. I don't know. How easy do you think it is to make Yeshua marvel? There's a few places that I think of, you know. Even in Israel, I have not seen such faith. Once again, talking about somebody that wasn't a Jew. Obviously. And this, he marveled. And turning to the crowd that followed him, said, I tell you, not even... Oh, I'm sorry. This is that passage, but I was thinking of the other, another passage that sounds strikingly similar about a certain person's faith. It's the and the woman that says, well, yeah, you know, but even the dogs get to eat up the crumbs that are under the table of the children. I'm not proud. I'll eat the crumbs. Those crumbs will heal me. Those crumbs will bring to me what I am seeking you for. Those crumbs are holy and marvelous. And so I'm not proud because I know that even the crumbs of your kingdom are life. She might as well have said. So anyway... I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the servant well. So, why is this a messianic moment? Or messianic minutes, perhaps? Maybe minute, messianic, quarter hour. We'll decide on the name. But why is this a messianic moment? Okay, well... So what I see here is a picture of what the believing body within Israel and those that came from the nations that believed. It's a picture of the relationship that should have been. It was at this point. The centurion believed in God. He believed in the God of Israel. That's the God that he went to. So they were in unity. They weren't the same. They knew they weren't the same. The centurion even humbles himself and says, well, I'm not even worthy to come and talk to you, but I'll send people of your people to talk to you. And so here you see this guy. He built their synagogue. He blesses them. He receives, there's mutual blessing. Blessing comes to him. And I'm sure it already had, because he wouldn't be acting in these ways and being called worthy if he had not already been in relationship with them that he found to be worthwhile and beneficial, and that also benefited Israel. So I think that this is a picture of how it was meant to be. I think this is a picture of how it should now be. And I actually don't think that just because certain things happened the way they did, it means that that's what God intended. So anyway, now these are just a few little things. I don't have time to go into them. But there's a certain person who wrote a certain book. His name's Paul Van Buren. And this is one of his arguments. Only one Jew is essential to the church, and that is the Jew Jesus. Yeah, it is terrible. So, I just hope you, I can't put it all, it would take much too long, but I'll read you a quote from R. Kendall Solon's book, The God of Israel and Christian Theology. Traditionally, the church has understood itself as a spiritual fellowship in which the carnal distinction between Jew and Gentile no longer applies. If perchance you're only familiar with the word carnal as a negative word that stands for sin, that's not what it means here. You may all be fully aware of that. It's just a reference to flesh and blood human. The church has declared itself a third and final race that transcends and replaces the difference between Israel and the nations. The proper therapy for this misunderstanding is a recovery of the church's basic character as a table fellowship of those who are and remain different. The distinction between Jew and Gentile being intrinsic to God's work as the consummator of creation is not erased by but realized in a new way in the sphere of the church. The church concerns the Jew as a Jew and the Gentile as a Gentile, not only initially or for the period of a few generations, but essentially at all times. So this will probably have to conclude the messianic moments. If saying that didn't bring the conclusion in an untimely way, how many of you have an idea about when the schism between the Jewish believers and the non-Jewish believers really, really came? Well, that was a big one. But I'll just say that the evidence is, and I'm not going to present it, is that in the third to into the fourth century, it was that late, and the evidence is that it happened in the non-Jewish portion first, and only began to happen the Jewish portion as a response to the rejection from the non-Jewish portion. Yeah, and none of that seems to me to be corresponding with God's plan and will for there to be one body, one bread, one blood, one drink, one fellowship. It just doesn't seem to be. That doesn't mean that God's will doesn't end up being done through all the horrible things that have happened, because God does work all things together for the good. But that's not the same as saying God has caused all things to be good. He can bring good out of things that were bad, that weren't meant to be. After all, didn't he warn Cain before he murdered his brother? Didn't he tell him what he should do? Didn't he say, sin is crouching at your door, but you must master it? And Cain, it would seem, did not do what God's will was, which was kill his brother. And I think perhaps the Lord whispered to a lot of people down through history, sin is crouching at your door. Don't do it. But they did it. So what I see in this chapter in Luke really is a picture of not separation, not magnified difference between groups that aren't the same, but a magnified power and the blessing of God coming to fruit. And so there should be unity in the body, even where there's difference, and there's room for all, and everyone should be cherished. So that concludes the messianic moment. I don't even have to give the message I was going to give. What would you like me to do? What? Okay, well, I'm missing something I have to have. This fell to the floor when the scriptures talk about words not falling to the floor or the ground. It's probably not about your words that you wrote down won't fall to the ground if the book drops. Otherwise, it would float. The message I was going to give, I've thought of titles. One of them is A Simple Twist of Faith. Maybe we'll go with that. A Simple Twist of Faith. Anybody know of something called fate? Anybody here believe in fate? What? What?
We'll talk about it later.
Well, Bob Dylan sang a song called "The Simple Twist of Fate," and I looked at it and I decided there was no reason to actually read you the lyrics, but it kind of delineates certain events, probably temptation, and somebody falling to a simple twist of fate. And then sort of looking for it again. And basically, the result doesn't seem very positive to this simple twist of fate. And sometimes we can act as though we're powerless and that we have no power to affect anything. Is that ever true?
No.
Okay. That's not true. So we may not have the power to do certain things, but the good news is that whatever we don't have the power to do isn't something that God wanted us to do. And that frees us from feeling like we should try to do it if it's something that God didn't will us to do. So by the way, as you read through Exodus, you can see a picture not just of the happenings of that time, but you can see a picture of things that are going on right now. What does Pharaoh represent? The God of this world, would you agree? The powers of darkness, idolatry, pride, and the desire to be one's own God, and then it can go farther and become a desire to be other people's God. So it's a world power, and so let me see. I have to find these scriptures. Okay, so then the refrain to a simple twist of faith is, it goes like this: by faith, by faith, by faith, by faith. You got it? Everyone say it back to me.
By faith, by faith, by faith, by faith.
Hey, I'm starting to get into this stuff I used to hate. But if you're sitting there and you refuse to say it, it's okay. I sympathize. I used to live there. So, by faith, by faith, by faith, by faith. By faith what? What should we do by faith? Everything. Everything that we do should be done in faith. And if we can't do it in faith, we shouldn't do it. And by the way, there is that one troubling passage that says, whatever doesn't come from faith is sin. Woo-hoo! But, you know, we should just meditate on that and think, well, see, we can have faith. We don't have to be faithless in anything. So that passage isn't so frightening. But if we're doing something that's not in faith, well, then I guess maybe that's an implication about it. So anyway, Moses, he goes back to Egypt. Did he want to go? He didn't want to go. Did he feel powerful? No, he didn't feel powerful. Did he have arguments about why he shouldn't go? He did, yeah. And really, I mean, what was Moses? What was he? Yes, he's just a man, right? What? A shepherd. A shepherd with a stick in his hand.
An ex-prince,
yeah. I don't know if he was still angry. Okay, so when Moses went back, who on earth do you think he was? What did he go as? Okay, so did he go as a slave?
No.
Did he go as a free man?
Yes or no?
He went as a slave of a different master.
You're speaking in human terms. But Paul did it, so like, that's okay.
Well, yeah, because if Paul did it...
Yeah, but he spoke in human terms to try to make it more... possible for people to relate.
Well, what are you speaking?
I'm. I believe Moses went back as a single man. Well, Aaron came out and met him, but you know he started to go. He was just one man. I believe he was free. I believe he was free. You can't act in obedience to God without being freed by God to do so, can you? I think he was a free man. But what power did he really have? He comes to a world power with a staff in his hand who has been oppressing his people. And why wasn't it that they didn't just grab him and either execute him or turn him into a slave? Why?
It wasn't God's
will. Yeah, it would seem so. I mean, when you think about it, would they have had to put up with him?
Yeah, I think they could have shunted him aside, but maybe it wouldn't have been so easy.
I mean, look, in human terms, they could have just gotten rid of him. But it seems...
Even an unbeliever can recognize when God is in the house.
Yeah, eventually. So he went back... freed to fulfill his purpose, even if he wasn't entirely willing. And he may have been. It wasn't the Pharaoh that Moses fled from. So anyway, in this. In this present era, there's a lot of pressure It would seem in Egypt there was pressure to worship Pharaoh and worship whatever false gods there were. And so this is what Moses did. It says in Hebrews 11, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Considering the reproach of Messiah, well, it says Moses considered the reproach of Messiah greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. It says even when he left Egypt he had faith. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch them. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through dry land, and the Egyptians, when they attempted it, were drowned. So Moses went at God's command, and the result was slaves were made free. A great world power was put to shame. In this week's Torah portion, there were seven plagues. In this week's passage that was read from Revelation, there were seven bowls of wrath. If you read in Revelation, it seems, it's interesting. There are lots of theories about Revelation. I read a little bit of it, and I learned that in the 15-somethings that the, I think it was the first bowl was poured out on the popery. And all these things, and I think the end of that bowl of God's wrath was finished off by the reformers. And so that happened long before any of us were born. I don't know what you think. And then it goes on to the next bowl, and it gives the dates when that happened. I think it may leave some of the, like the last ones, maybe to happen still. But I don't know. I mean, from my perspective, the Pope still exists, and the Catholic Church is a pretty big thing, and I'm not so sure that the Catholic Church is actually the Whore of Babylon. But at any rate, what I'm looking at is that the Scriptures give us a picture not only of the world as it was once and bad things that happened and oppression that happened, but the world as it is in many ways now, and a picture of things that repeat over and over in history in many different ways. And God is always in charge, and God can always break the bondage in every age, at any time, in any way that he chooses, including the time we live in. So I see great pressure these days to bow down to certain things. And it's pretty insidious. It's pretty all-pervasive. It's woven into commercials. It's woven into television shows. It's woven into clothes. And there's a brand of jeans called True Religion. I think Dean works across the street from where... Oh, it's in the same building. True Religion. And I happen to know that that True Religion, in that case, other than the jeans themselves, is Buddhism. Am I not correct? I believe the guy is a Buddhist. Okay. Well, yeah, Buddhism can accept everything. And I will. And by the way, if you want to know what happens to Yeshua, I don't mean Yeshua himself, But the message of Yeshua, what happens to the message of Yeshua when Buddhism accepts it? What happens to it?
It becomes a different message.
Yes, it becomes a different message. It just becomes absorbed into this great bunch of stuff. And so, in effect, he disappears. The only reason he can remain is because it doesn't matter. It has no impact. They can call him a great teacher. They can say, oh, he taught some great stuff. They can say all kinds of things about him, and they will. Many of them will tell you, oh, I accept Yeshua, or I accept Jesus. They'll say that. But it's a different kind of acceptance, and it's an acceptance that the truth is removed from, and therefore it's not acceptance. So there's all this pressure everywhere. And so, is it possible for you to think of yourself as Moses in miniature or Yeshua in miniature? Or is that not a useful concept? What? Yeah, I met a guy once, some of you met him too, his name was Yesupadam. Yesupadam, you know what it means? The hands and feet of Jesus. I don't think that was his given name, but it was his name when I encountered him. So can you think of yourself as the hands and feet of Yeshua in this world?
But nothing else.
What?
But nothing else. He's got plenty.
Please.
Of good
parts. Being the hands and feet of Yeshua means your feet carry his work to wherever you go, and your hands do it wherever you are. That is being the hands and feet of Yeshua. Walking where he would have you walk with his power and his message, and doing with your hands what he would have done with his hands, that is being the feet and the hands of Yeshua in this world.
It does say you can all prophesy, so we should be able to be the mouth of Yeshua.
Yes, all of it. Okay. No, not only the hands and feet. I'm going to try to. I'm going to wrap this up. I think when we read through Exodus, we should really see an actual, true historical account, and also a picture of what God does, did, and will do, and be able to see ourselves in the original Exodus, and also in terms of an Exodus that is ongoing and will happen. And so we can bring redemption into dark places, and we can go. By faith, refuse. These are the things I want you to remember. By faith, refuse. Refuse to be frightened, intimidated, or controlled by the God of this world and the things that are pressuring us today. Refuse. By faith, refuse. There are different kinds of refusal, but refusing by faith is different. It works. By faith, choose. Hebrews 11:25. Choosing, rather, to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. By faith, have mercy with fear. Jude 1:22-23. And have mercy on some who are doubting. Save others, snatching them out of the fire. On some have mercy with fear, hating even the garment polluted by the flesh. Now to him who is able to keep you from stumbling and to make you stand in the presence of his glory blameless, with great joy, to the only God, our Savior, through Messiah, Yeshua, our Lord, be glory, majesty, dominion, and authority before all time, and now, and forever. Amen. By faith, remain unstained. James 1:27. Pure and undefiled religion is this. Religion before our God and Father is this: to care for orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted or stained by the world. There are a lot of things that begin to sound really smart and wise and seem to be true. And this is what it says about the people that carry those things. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workers, disguising themselves as apostles of Messiah. No wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. Therefore, it is not surprising if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness, whose end will be according to their deeds. By faith, keep your eyes on the pioneer and author of faith. I have to turn to that one. Looking to Yeshua, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. And then I have to turn to that one too. 1 Peter 2, live as free men and women. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the emperor. Honor everyone. We really have to keep our eyes on Yeshua and keep the word in our hearts, and hold on to faith. We really need to, by faith, refuse, and by faith, choose. By faith, have mercy with fear. By faith, remain unstained by the world. And by faith, keep our eyes on Yeshua, the author and the perfecter of our faith. So, by faith, occupy. We are the true Occupy movement. The scriptures say, occupy until I come. It is we who are to be the occupiers. And by faith, we can occupy. We can refuse. We can choose. We can honor God. We can overcome temptation. We can speak the healing word to people that are looking for it, needing it, longing for it, who are groping in slavery and oppression. And it's our calling, it's our right, it's our privilege. And despite what we see when we look at ourselves, God can work these things through you, through us, through me. It's about God who wills and God who runs and God who has mercy, not about our personal power and volition. And so we have the victory. And we will never bow to anything but God by faith. May the Lord bless you and cause his countenance to shine on you and be gracious to you and scoop you up in his arms and slather his love on you and kiss you and tell you how much he loves you and give you peace. Ivarekha Adonai Vaishmarekha Yair Adonai Panavelekha Vekunekha Isa Adonai Panavelekha Vyasem Lekha Shalom.